Welcome back to the Filmmakers Roundtable. This is Domenico Pontoriero, and I am joined here again with Susanna Darwin and Mace Walker. Today we're going to be talking about some of the technical aspects of filmmaking right here on Radio St. Pete. Mace, take it away.
Good morning, guys. All right, let's jump right into it. This is one of my favorite topics, technical aspects. So let's start with recent advancements in filmmaking technology and how have you incorporated that into your work? And I guess I would interpret that too as, do you use AI? How do you guys feel about that? I don't know. I feel like that's an interesting conversation to have. And when it comes to like digital and film, what are your takes on that? How do you...
Well, it depends on what you mean by recent, because when I was originally starting to write Hatboxes, which was my first short, I was imagining shooting it in black and white on 16mm film without sync sound because it was going to be cheaper to do that. That was in 1995.
Oh, wow.
Okay? I made the film in 2012. By the time we got to making the film, it would have been a stupid use of money and pretentious, frankly, to shoot on film, on analog.
Yeah.
We shot on digital, and it's beautiful. We shot in color. We shot with sync sound. And I can still remember what I was envisioning, but what we got was great. And I watched the shift from analog to digital that happened over the course of that period. Flag Act, very recently made, we shot it in 2023, incorporates drone shots. So that's, you know, we've largely kept up with the technology that way. I have not deployed AI. I'd rather AI washed the dishes for me than did creative work for me, on the one hand. On the other hand, I can imagine situations where it could be very useful.
Like as a tool, but not...
As a tool.
Yeah.
But I don't really...
Not a partner with a... Not a creative partner.
No, exactly.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
I think I may have used AI. I'm also not a big fan of AI. Not yet, anyway. I also would prefer it to do my taxes and do my dishes and the things that I don't want to do. But there was a point, like I mentioned in the last episode, I really want to be good at, like, you know, color correcting and color grading and color matching, but I'm not. It's really hard.
It's a huge skill.
It is.
It's just massive.
It is, and it takes a lot of time, and I kept messing it up.
It's like painting, yeah, understanding the color wheel and...
Yeah, but Adobe Premiere does have a feature that I assume is AI that allows you to do color matching, so you can take one scene and throw it up in a window, and then take another clip and throw it up in a window, and you use what I assume is AI to match the colors so that they're closer aligned. Because we used two different cameras, right?
So right.
Oh, really? Okay.
So we used, you know, I don't remember the exact. It was like a Canon something, and then we used...
I'm not a gearhead either.
Okay. So then we used a drone for part of it as well, right? And so the drone had a very different color profile, right?
Right.
Than the really nice Canon that we had. And so I did not like that. So I wanted them to look I wanted it to look seamless. I wanted them to match up. And I was really struggling with that. And so luckily I was using Adobe Premiere, and so it has that color correction. And I'm so thankful, because finding and hiring colorists, is that what they're called?
I've got your guy for next time.
Do you?
Yes.
Okay, good, because it's hard.
Yes, it is.
And it's something I was like, I'm going to figure this out. I'm going to learn how to do this. And then I got into it, and I was watching all these videos, and there's maps and all this stuff and
well,
all these different things.
Correct, like, but color grading is like a whole other ballpark.
It's a whole thing.
Yeah.
What about you?
No, I was just thinking about how I agree with you guys about the AI thing and how it should be used for a tool. But I'm open-minded, so I'm totally, like, if someone had a different opinion, I have many friends that actually do use it for creative reasons and wanted to co-write scripts, and I have my own opinions about that, but you know, go crazy if that's what you want to do. I just hope it doesn't take over and take opportunities. But there's always going to be opportunities. We'll make them. One thing about the color too, I just discovered this. I was a big hater of ChatGPT for a while, but then I started talking to people who disagreed with me, and my mind was kind of blown. And I didn't want to hear it at first, but then I was like, okay, this is cool. And what you can ask it to make LUTs and filters, and but the way that you do that is by asking it to give you, you tell it what software you're using, and say, I want you to make a LUT for Premiere Pro or DaVinci Resolve that involves yellow tones, that gives you kind of a moody feel. You can explain, you can get so detailed. That's what I did with it. Like, you're talking to a person, right? You give it a bunch of crap and it will summarize it. But it will give you step by step on how to make a LUT if that's wow. like not your, yeah, if that's like not your thing. And it actually, I saw someone do it on, I think, I don't have TikTok, but I saw a reel on Instagram and I was like, this is a really creative way to use it. I would have never thought about that. And obviously that's not replacing color graders. ChatGPT isn't going to come up with something on the spot that's better than the guy that graded Joker, but it can give you something inspired by that. I want something, you know, that kind of resembles the Joker color profile or Mulholland Drive, something like that. It can help you with that. And it's, and you're still doing it yourself. It's giving you the steps. And so you're also learning in the process. Another thing I like is the, and we were talking about this when we weren't recording, we were talking about the software that kind of limits background noise. But I know that, like, often it can distort as well, so it's not perfected yet by any means, but DaVinci Studio is what I edit in, and I love they're not really known for audio editing, by the way. Like, it's mainly for color grading, actually, and then became a free software to edit. You can edit a whole feature film in it, by the way, so that's why I switched from Adobe. But anyway, this isn't a biased podcast or anything, but they have this awesome effect where you can eliminate you can isolate people's voices. Now, if you have someone talking in the background, it can make it worse, because then you can hear exactly what they're saying, or so it doesn't get rid of that. But if you're filming outside and you have the wind and stuff, like, that's always been something that I could never figure out, and I tried with tutorials, like you were saying with the color, like, it was hard, you were trying to figure it out. Like, I was so determined to figure out how to get rid of certain frequencies, and it's so difficult, especially too, like, if someone's, you know, has a deeper voice and there's a fan in the background, well, if you're trying to eliminate the fan, well, it has some tones in it that are frequencies that are similar to this person's voice, you know, and it's going to remove and distort part of their voice. So it's so complicated. So if you can have AI get rid of the busy work for you, it is like doing the dishes of filmmaking. So it's not like, yeah, it's not like infiltrating the creative aspects of it. So that's the type of technology advancements that I like about that kind of thing. And I hope we can stick to that and not have, I heard there was a movie written by just AI, but it had a lot of negative responses. And I don't think people are going to bow down to that and worship AI movies, because ultimately real human stories win every time. People want to relate. So I think it's going to go in a positive direction, which is completely opposite of my opinion. Last year, I was very negative towards it and was like, oh my God, everything is over, my career. But then I remembered, oh, I don't even have one. It's fine. So anyway, okay. So does anyone want to add anything else about that, or can we move on to the next question?
I'd say let's move on.
All right. We've had enough of AI. Let's go on.
We have. Sorry, that's one of my favorite topics. All right, so let's talk about cinematography techniques and how you use those to enhance your storytelling in films. Do you have a specific style that you go with? Do you look at other films first that kind of resemble what you're going for? Or do you kind of just off the dome, like, come up with stuff? Do you make a shot list? What are your processes?
Oh, that's a good question. The actual cinematography, there's so much involved. And I learned so much just my first real thing, right? So it's a little bit of all those, all of the above, right? You got to do the storyboarding. You've got to, even for something as simple as my piece, like, you have to know what angles you're gonna shoot, right? You want to know where the camera is going to go, where the subject is going to be, what's going to be in the background. It was very important. At one point, I was getting so overthinking it a little bit, where I was like, okay, I want these pieces in the background of this shot and these pieces in the background of this shot. And it was just too much. I had to scale it down. Mm-hmm. Storyboarding is, I think, important. I also, there were some other films that I watched to give me a reference point before I started filming, or even as I was developing my concept, right? I watched other, specifically dance films, to understand how the camera moves, what an impact it made on the viewer to see as someone dancing from the waist up, or just the face versus the entire body, right? Like, what kind of an impact does it have on the viewer? How does the viewer feel? What is the movement like? That was really important. Where do I incorporate, like, a continuous seamless shot? Like, how does that work? And so I learned a lot from watching other dance films, because I'm really interested in capturing the emotion of this piece. And I did something that I pieced together from what I learned, which was in the beginning of the piece, it's a lot of different angles and different shots cut together, right? So the beginning is very heavy and unsettling in a way, right? And then as we continued through, I used a lot of like longer takes. I wanted to show the beauty of the movement through the space, right? And so that is something that I learned from watching other dance films, other films, right? And then towards the end, we used the drone, which was really cool because we were able to like fly out and see the movement in this grand space. And all of that I learned by watching how other films treated the dancer. And so that was really insightful.
I like that. And it goes hand in hand with editing too. So you have to have an idea of how you're going to edit it. Like you were saying, you wanted all those shots at the beginning. And I like what you said about how you switched to just the dancer for a while. And that's something you have to learn as a filmmaker, to know when to back off and let the actor carry the scene. And it sounds like that's what you did with your film a lot.
And it was hard. Mm-hmm. It was challenging, right? We had to do a lot of takes, right? Because you have to get it right. I didn't want to edit that part. Right. So we had to do that several times. The beginning was in a way easier to shoot because I just needed, you know, content, right? Like we just filmed a few takes and that was it. But the continuous shot was hard because I wanted it to be just right.
Yeah.
So we had to shoot it, like review it, make sure we got it all right. So it's interesting, different challenges.
Well, the cameraman, the camera person, I don't, that's just automatic for me for whatever reason. But the cinematographer has to be in sync, like with the actor, obviously, and like blocking can be complicated and making sure people, you know, are on their marks, especially if they can't look down like that. So that's it's definitely an art to get that right. What about you, Susanna? Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no, I was going to say one thing I did have in working in my favor was that I didn't care about the sound. So, right. So we were able to talk as he was, you know, as he was filming, because I just wanted the music to be up front and center. Mm-hmm. So that was a little bit helpful, right? You know?
Had to be huge.
Yeah, yeah.
To be able to narrate what you want as it's happening. That's really something. I have to echo what you said about storyboarding. I'm really meticulous about storyboarding, in part to make sure that there are no, I call them logic bombs in a script, and you can expose, like if you're imagining somebody comes around a corner and it turns out that the set doesn't have that corner, you have to figure out how to make that transition in a different way. And I've found that storyboarding in a very disciplined manner really contributes to pacing and making sure that the crew all understand what's going on. And one of the things that I've actually done with Flag Act is if you sit down with the Flag Act storyboards and you watch the film with the storyboards in your lap or, you know, in your hand, it pretty much tracks. I mean, there may be three shots that are framed differently, for example, but I'm not a gearhead, at least when it comes to camera equipment. So I depend on the cinematographer, director of photography, who usually is a gearhead, to be present about, you know, what lens do we need to use? How do you want to do the framing? What sort of lighting choices do we need to make? Are we lighting from inside or outside? That contributes to the warmth of the scene or the chill of it, the mood of it. Between starting with the script, because I start with the words, and then coming along behind with the storyboards, and then working with the crew to achieve the mood that you've already communicated. I think it's a way to create unity among the crew and the cast so that you achieve what you have in mind.
Can I ask a follow-up question about your storyboarding process?
Yeah.
What do you use a program to storyboard, or are you sketching it out?
For Hatboxes, it was pen to paper. And for Longer and Flag Act both, I use my iPad.
Okay.
And so there's an app called the program Procreate to create storyboards. And the nice thing about it is that you can sort of use repeat palettes. You can use repeat backgrounds. moved the character around in in the scene, close up.
Oh, cool.
I've heard a lot of good things about Perfect.
Yeah, it's great. And it's overwhelming as apps go because it can do so much. But if you just start small and build up from there, it's been super useful, yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, and that way, if you have trouble explaining your vision or you're thinking you're on different pages with it, you have the picture to reference. So that's why you always need a shot list. Unless you haven't scouted your location in your guerrilla filming for whatever reason or sometimes. Not that I've ever done it, but and it doesn't match up. Like you're saying, you could definitely have issues with the editing process later. And if you have a shot that comes after, if you have a medium shot and then it cuts to another medium shot and it lines up weird, it can look really jarring too. So you have to make sure you have a variety of things. And yeah, so our next question is, your philosophy on editing and how do you approach the post-production process, which I guess this is what we're talking about now.
Yeah, so I would say the smart thing to do, really the efficient thing to do, and also the kind thing to do, both to yourself and to the editor, is trust that the editor has selected the best shot.
I love that so much. Thank you. Thank you very much.
And you're welcome. Because, you know, there are going to be instances where, you know, you as the director are going to say, wasn't there like a fifth take? And the editor says, yeah, the fifth take. Well, here it is, and here's the fourth take.
That's why I don't sit with the director when I edit. That's actually a rule of mine. I have lots of meetings, like, weekly, and I show it to them, but not, I'm not having them with their hand.
I don't want to watch you knit.
There you go. Because usually, once you show them what you're going for, there's a reason why I select things that are not what they wanted. I try to incorporate everything that they want, but there's sometimes...
Right, but I think there has to be room for the director to go, what about shot, or take five?
Of course.
And then you explain, well, take five had the weird stutter moment, blah, 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 whatever it is. And then you take that. As the director, you accept that because the editor is usually right. That said, I do want to say that there are instances where I think it's more about timing, where, you know, how a joke lands, for example, that, you know, to make the cut half a second later, just say. And if there's disagreement over whether that works or not, eventually the director is the one to own that, and you have to be prepared to own it. And to be, you know, kind and collegial and professional about insisting on what you want, but that you have to own your decisions as the director.
Absolutely, yeah. Because ultimately, what matters is you're working for the director, and you know, you want it to turn out the way that they envision it. So I've had issues like that where I think one thing looks better, but the director is like, I'm thinking of something else. And of course, I don't take it personal because that's their, you know, project, their passion project, and it's totally up to them. But usually they can see why I chose something over something else. And also, once they incorporate the isolation, I try to just not send stuff as much because usually, they forget what takes they have. And so they're not so, like, you know, because you do get attached to it. I did it with mine. But if you're so attached to it and it's so specific that you can't explain, you're not getting what you want, you should learn to edit yourself. Because maybe that sounds harsh, but because some people, I couldn't imagine someone else editing my film. I might let them one day because they might come up with something that I didn't even think of. It's not that I think I'm the best. I have such a specific vision, and sometimes I'm bad at explaining it. I just also love to edit as well. So, if you have such a specific concept and you want it, you don't want it to let anybody have any of their ideas, or it's got to be this specific way, then yeah, learn to edit yourself and, you know, go on YouTube. There's tons of tutorials. Anyway.
Spoken as an editor.
What about you? Maybe that was a bit passive aggressive. I meant it like own it, you know, do it your way. Who cares if it's just your name in the credits? That means you're freaking cool. You did it all.
So becoming myself, and there were moments where I had to stop and ask myself, like, oh, wasn't there a fifth take, like Susanna mentioned? Like, wait, there definitely was a better one. And then you have to work with what you got, because
there always is in your head that one perfect take that never happened.
I know. And so editing, of course, always takes a lot longer than you think it should when you're editing. I am interested in my next project. I am interested in hiring like an editor, yeah, someone who's, that's their main thing. I'm interested in working with an expert in editing. I enjoyed editing my own film. Like it was fun. It is a bit tedious at times.
Mm-hmm.
But I did enjoy it because I think like you, Mace, I did have a very specific vision of how things would play out. And I was very obsessed with seeing that all come together. Quite frankly, I thought it would be, I don't want to say easier, but I thought it wouldn't take me as long as it did end up taking me. So I was like, I can do this. And I did do it. But I think on my next project, I think it would be fun to work with an editor. I'm like really into collaborating, and I'm very interested in that relationship between director and editor.
Yeah.
I think it just sounds like something I want to experience.
When I'm editing I just finished it, but I'm still touching it up. I edited a feature film for a first-time director, and it was same problems that everyone has, same thing that I had with my first feature film. There's stuff that he didn't think of and technical issues. And what I was doing is he started out, now we're very good friends, but at first, you know, he was one of my clients, and we spoke about what he wanted. He had so many, you know, specific rules for it. And it was all intentional because I could see what he was going for, but it's also kind of like an artsy, non-conventional type of film. We were talking about endings earlier, and I think that was the last episode that we did. The ending is very kind of what you guys were saying. What was that word that
ambiguous.
You used? Ambiguous, yeah. Which I actually ended up changing the ending by cutting out a scene from earlier in the film that I didn't feel like really fit there, and added it at the end, but I didn't tell him. I sent it to him, and if he wanted me to, of course I would take it out, but he emailed me and was like, I love it. I would have never thought about that. It ties it in so well, because it was really just a long shot. There was no talking or anything like that. It was like a big wide shot, and the character is sitting at this lake, and it works because that's kind of how she starts out. Like, she's this character that's always on the run, and she's just right back where she started. And so I was like, we have so many shots and so many scenes, like, we don't need all of this, so let me find a way to give it more of an impactful ending. And so now that we're better friends, like, he trusts me more, and so we built that relationship over time, because it took a really long time to edit because of all the technical issues, and they switched cameras, and their DP actually lied on his resume, so like, he didn't know how to do a lot of things. I mean, he did hire him off of Reddit, so you get what you get with that kind of thing, but he had a black magic. It was cool. But yeah, I mean, what I do too is, and I don't charge extra for this, if I feel really confident about a scene I did, I edit my own version, and then I do it the way the director wanted it. And so, because I want them to have options, and if I have extra time, editing is one of my passions, so it's not like I'm like, okay, I'm getting paid overtime for this extra editing. I want to show what, you know, what my idea is versus theirs. And usually, not to brag, but they usually go with my idea. It's a separation from the film, too. When you're, like you said, you get obsessed with it. And that was my issue with my film editing, and maybe I will, you know, one day hand it over to someone else, because it's crushing, too, because you have this idea, and it's frustrating. It's hard to focus when you're realizing, wait, do I not have that fifth take, or do it, you know, right. You felt so good about it, and you're like in the shower, like, wow, this is gonna be so good, like, I'm so excited about this and dreaming about it all day, and then you sit down at the computer and you're like, what the hell, this is, who shot this, not me. Like, you know, and it can distract you, it can be hard to keep going. And that's been one of my biggest struggles in the last like 5 years of doing this stuff, is getting turned off by it and, you know, getting frustrated, like, this isn't what I wanted, and walking away and being too depressed to touch it for a couple days. And really, the story finds itself ultimately, is what I'm trying to say. If you can accept that it's probably not going to be the way you had it in your head, it's not going to be your best work ever, so don't worry about it. You're going to only get better. And if you're open to learning, then your next film is automatically guaranteed to be better the next time.
It does take on a life of its own at some point,
it
right?
Does. Yeah. And sometimes you have to take things out of context to give them context. Sometimes things come out differently, and things can work. I even use candid shots of actors when, not when the camera's moving, but sometimes I always do this. My DB hates me for it, but because we burn media, whatever. But I always keep the camera rolling when it's stabilized, even if we're not filming yet, because sometimes I need shots of the actor like just zoning out or looking a certain way, or sometimes they make an expression that I use later. I use a lot of stuff. My last film, that the most recent one that I did, I had a professional kid actor that ended up not being able to do it because he was working on another project and he was sick. So I had to replace him with a kid that had no experience, that was a family friend's kid. Very outgoing and theatrical in real life, but he was very camera shy and not a good actor. And not to crap on him, because he's not an actor, so of course he's not a good actor. But I used mostly candid takes of him just laughing and talking with us. And I had to figure out a weird way to incorporate it and make it look natural. So anyway, I'm rambling here.
That's your secret.
It is, yeah, the secret recipe.
I have a secret I want to share, actually. I forgot that I did this. So I'm going to lean in dramatically into the microphone as I tell the secret.
Yes.
So one of the ways I overcame some of the challenges with editing, I think it's always a good idea to fall back on your strengths. I wrote the music for the piece first and then filmed. And the idea was to then piece together the film onto the music, right? You're editing over the music. To get it to work better, what I did was I did that. I edited over the piece. And then I re-recorded the piece over the film. So I did like a double.
That's over. A really brilliant idea.
Because I could do it, right? Because I wrote and recorded the piece. So I was like, let me re-record it so I can inject the right emotion at the exact points in the film as it's happening. So I was able to react.
Like you could goose it with a fermata here.
Right.
And like a pianissimo there.
Right, right. And that really helped really drive home the emotion that I wanted, and also helped with editing, because there was like the timing of things. Sometimes mm-hmm. Sometimes we didn't get it perfect, right? But I was able to re-record it and get the timing right, so that I didn't have to. The editing was a little easier then.
That's very cool.
That's really smart.
That's my secret.
I always put the score first. And I don't know if other editors do it this way, but I always put the music down on the timeline first, so that I do that too. I time it to the music, and it's like my blueprint. Like when there's a shift in the tone of the music and it changes, now I know to cut to something else or to slow down or change the pacing of the editing. So I think that music obviously like it really is like a film's best friend. I think that
Walter Murch would be really proud of you.
I think
he's the one that says that all film happens on the soundtrack.
Really? I don't know who he is, so I feel like you might be disappointed in me, but
you can go. No, seriously, you can look him up. He's amazing.
So intrigued now. Yes. Okay. Yeah, and this segues into our last question perfectly. How do you incorporate sound design so it's a little bit different than the score to create the atmosphere and an emotional impact?
This is all you two, because I have no... Mine is just music.
Just music? Okay.
It's just music. I removed all the sound. I wanted it just to be the music.
Susanna?
In an ideal world, your sound designer would be with you from pre-production so that... their ideas and their sophistication around using sound can infuse your planning. It would be great to have them around for production. I'm talking small productions of short films. But you can certainly alter tone, you can alter tension, you can alter mood with the work that the sound designer does after the production is over. You can develop sense of character. It's pretty amazing what a post-production sound designer can do. And then, I don't even really like talking about sound design and music separately. I want them to be so integrated. But I think one of the important things that if you're doing a more straight-up narrative film, the question is, do you want the film to be basically a sonata where the music is running all the way through it, and almost like the picture is in service of the music, or are the moving images and the music sort of enhancing each other, promoting the dynamism of both?
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost, if you don't have room for silence or for quiet anyway, then you are ceding too much power to possibly the music or other elements, but I'm thinking specifically the music. So it winds up being another moment of like balance and coordination among the elements of the completed piece.
It's like an orchestra, I guess, the way you're describing it. So no one's louder, everyone's kind of, it's at the same volume, but you can hear everything separately. And that's the artistry of sound mixing.
Yeah.
And there's a lot that goes into post-production of audio designers, the Foley artist.
I was going to ask if either of you used Foley artist or if there was any Foley.
I did, but like, let's be real. It wasn't like I hired a Foley artist out of LA. It was me on freesound.com, like footsteps, door slam. But I know how it really works, okay? Yeah, and I'll get there one day. I'll have my own footstep person.
Should we explain to the listeners what a Foley artist is? This is a common knowledge, what a Foley artist does.
Yeah, a Foley artist essentially records all the audio in a film that might overpower, like, conversation, just things so that they can get it separate. Like if it's overlapping, like I'm describing it really crappy. I had such a great definition in my head. Basically, if someone's walking and they're talking at the same time, you would want to re-record. There's actually a Foley artist that will watch that recording and walk in sync with the microphone.
Like, I just imagine somebody with like shoes on their hands.
Videos. There's people that they'd even do Foley for intimate scenes, like kissing scenes. Like a Foley artist literally will kiss their hand and will sync it with a makeout scene, that hot makeout scene. You know, the scenes in 50 Shades of Grey, there's probably some dude kissing his hand for that and made a bunch of money and is living in a high rise in LA because of that. But it just shows you all the components that go into it. It really is even
good to plan. Yeah. It's actually good to plan for because there's a scene in Hatboxes and we meant to have the actors take their shoes off and we forgot. And they're talking to each other as they move. And if we had them take their shoes off, the floors might have creaked, but we wouldn't have the interference of the shoes clopping with them speaking. Now I notice it. Nobody else would really notice it. You'll notice it when you see the film. But it's that kind of thing that a Foley artist would do. They walk. I don't know if the audience knows they're wearing shoes, but they walk in bare feet. Then the Foley artist comes along and adds their footfalls afterwards. So you don't interfere with the speech.
And it
goes
back to what you were saying about not having things dominate each other, that especially things that aren't relevant and are distracting. And I haven't even thought about that, honestly, like footsteps and not wearing shoes. And I have heard that, and I don't think I've ever done that, but that makes so much sense because it's ultimately going to, especially with independent film, it's going to cost a lot more time and money to remove that, especially if the audio is, if it's lost data. Like this is something too that not all the amateur filmmakers know. There's a difference between removing background and, you know, having some audio that's peaked and distorted. Like it can't, AI can't fix what's not there. So you have to.
Correct.
Yeah, you can't have, and that's what essentially it is when you have like wind or when those frequencies are gone or essentially like overwritten by the natural elements, you know, you can't fix it. You have to ADR it. And that's controversial in the film world and people are like, oh, ADR, it's unprofessional. But sometimes you have to do it. And if you do it the right way and if you have, you know, room tone, that's also important for anyone that doesn't know what room tone is. It's 30 seconds. I think you need 30 minutes, but not really. Three minutes, it's never enough. There's always someone.
I love that moment.
There's always someone that breathes like, or something happens like weird, and the 30 seconds of room tone.
That moment when you collect room tone is almost like a religious ritual.
Oh my god, it is amazing. Though, because it's like you're like, oh my god, all the hard part, everything is done. We can just relax and listen to nothing for a bit.
We can chill. We can breathe, but not too
meditation,
loud.
Meditation,
exactly.
Loud.
And with regard to ADR, I mean, even with Longer, which was it's an 11-minute film. So Eugenie Bondurant, who's a local actor, and she teaches, she acts, and she's fabulous. When we shot Longer, there's a moment at the end where she goes, well, as in, you know, it has a very particular sort of emotional timbre. But we didn't capture that when we were shooting it. And we actually went back to her house, and I have a recording of Eugenie Bondurant saying, well, 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 well. like 40 times.
Yeah, you got to get the cadence right.
And I'm glad we did it because the well that winds up in the film is the one that needed to be there.
Because it's, yeah, it's crucial. And another thing too, I know we have to wrap up, but I was just thinking about how some films don't use a lot of music. They, and the sound design becomes the music. It becomes the score. Yeah. Kind of like Zone of Interest, you know? I think that's why that was, I don't know if you guys saw that movie. I highly recommend it. It's very heavy, but it's all based around the sound, and it's a slice of life. It's about the Holocaust, but you never see anything. It's all what you hear, and it's more disturbing in a way because it leads you up. It's really remarkable because the filmmakers are able to manipulate and make you, like, the audience, and really, without showing you anything, like, it just the visuals that you come up with from listening to that, and it's so detailed too. I'm sure seeing an IMAX would be insane, like listening to the surround sound with that. But I just went to see Parasite again because it was its 5th anniversary.
Wow.
And
jeez, that was 5 years ago.
Yeah, and it's one of my favorite movies, but I saw it in IMAX for my birthday at the Sundial, and I don't think I've ever seen an IMAX movie, like, as an adult. Like, I went as a kid to see, like, some nature movie or something, and I didn't have an appreciation for it. But I didn't, I thought it was just a bigger screen. I didn't realize it was surround sound, so I was like, I mean...
Yeah, the sound is the first thing I noticed.
I looked like a dog. I was like, oh my god, what's over there? You know, like, I was excited, because it really was like, you're there, you hear, like, you know, people talking over here, and you can hear what they're saying, but it's not distracting from what these characters are saying. There's a dog barking over there, and I mean, like, to be able to master that is incredible, because you're not, you know, seeing physical speakers. You're like, you're working with, you know, you would know this as a musician. I think it's just so, it takes a really talented person to be able to do that, to create that through audio. So anyway, does anyone have anything they want to add?
I was going to mention, when we're talking about sound, I had the privilege of sitting in the Stack Theater, which is the theater that they have on premise at Lucas Sound, right? That's George Lucas's sound production. And it is, you walk in there, and it's deafening when you first walk in, because the sound is, I guess they have it, so it's so soundproof. And you're sitting in the theater, and the wave of sound that you get is just incredible. And there's so many nuanced little things about sound that you don't even get in a regular theater. Like, the level of detail that some filmmakers will go through to get the sound just right, like, mm-hmm. the sound engineering, it goes so deep. And in a way, it's a shame that people watch a movie and they don't really think much about it.
You know, watch it on our laptops, and and the speakers are just, it almost sounds like it mono in a way. Yeah. Like, it's so flat. Whereas in a theater, you can actually feel it, like, in your bones. You can feel the movie going, you know, in and out of you. Anyway,
the takeaway of this is, next time you go see a movie, catch it in IMAX at least.
Yes, yeah. Make sure everything you see is in IMAX. And if you didn't see Oppenheimer in IMAX, then you're lame and you don't really like film. I'm just kidding. I didn't get to see it in IMAX, but everyone said that you should, or you're not cool and you're not a film lover. I don't know. I found that out after. All right.
Well, thank you for listening. This has been another installment of the Filmmakers Roundtable with myself, Domenico Monterrero, Susanna Darwin, and our host, Mace Walker. Tune in next time when we're going to be talking about industry challenges and distribution right here on Radio St. Pete, Sunshine 96.7 FM.